Shalom, and thank you for studying the Book of Galatians with us at BethEmmanuel.org.
Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's virtual community and support our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Now, thus far in the Epistle to the Galatians, we've noted that Paul is arguing for his radical message of the gospel, his radical interpretation of the gospel as it applies to non-Jews. This has been his theme, his argument. And Paul has just finished telling us about how one time he went to Jerusalem to discuss this with the pillars, with the apostles there. Whether or not God-fearing Gentiles should be placed under the compulsion to undergo circumcision, taking on the sign of the covenant, and completing a conversion process to become legally, halakhically Jewish. That was the question. And he happily reported to us that the pillars were on his side, and that they, not even Titus was with him at the time, was compelled to be circumcised. So thus far, in Galatians, Paul is citing this anecdotal testimony we've seen. He's just telling us stories, really. Telling us anecdotal testimony. And I said this is very similar to the Talmud. When you don't have a definitive halakhic ruling on something, the sages immediately start telling stories. They start telling, well, this is how Rab so-and-so handled it in such and such a time. And that is also the case here in Galatians. We don't have a definitive halakhic ruling on this question yet. That has, Acts 15 has not happened yet. And so Paul is telling us stories to make the argument for why he thinks he's right and everyone else is wrong. So, in verse 11, Paul begins to relate this second anecdote to buttress his contention that Gentiles do not need to keep the sign commandment of circumcision. In what has been called we're going to read a short story today, another of his anecdotes. It's the famous, or maybe infamous, Antioch incident. That's how scholars refer to it, as the Antioch incident. And it's a conflict between Peter and Paul. And this is, you know what, my idea here is to pass over this pretty quickly, because we at Beth Emmanuel have studied this passage, as they say, ad nauseum in the past, in the famous, now famous, Beth Emmanuel Kashrut Wars of 2008 and early 2009. So I hesitate to even open this material again, lest I sound, as Paul would say, like a clanging cymbal or a broken record. But let's do it and get it over with. Alright? So, verse 11 says, when Kephas, that's Peter, Kephas, when Peter came to Antioch, Paul says, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles, but when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Kephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? All right, now we're going to unpack this, of course, but first I want you to understand how the passage is normally taught and explained in the rest of the church. The traditional Christian interpretation of this passage presupposes that Paul and the Jewish believers that were with Paul had already, you know, that they had given up on Judaism, or they had given up Judaism and the practice of Torah, and they were not keeping Torah. All right? And then when these men from James come down, and Peter sees and he's influenced by them, he starts to waffle on this matter. And Paul sees Peter waffling, and because Peter, what Peter starts to do is he starts to practice some aspects of Torah, such as the Bible's dietary laws. And so Paul sees that Peter's not eating the lobster, and or something like this. You know, it's like something extraordinary like that. And he rebukes him for Judaizing. So Paul goes over to Peter and says, Peter, Stop that. Stop that Judaizing. So that's to say that Paul rebukes Peter from backsliding and going back under the law and into Judaism. That is the normal explanation of this passage. Okay, if you've not heard that before, it's because you haven't been paying attention. As Magnus Zetterholm of the Center of Theology for Religious Studies in Sweden states in his new book, Approaches to Paul, such a basic presupposition is far from self-evident. It's not at all certain that Paul's intention was that all Jews in the Jesus movement should stop observing the Torah. Furthermore, if the non-Jewish adherents of the Jesus movement were recruited from the group of non-Jews that already took part in activities of the synagogue, which I've been telling you about, the God-fearers, it's likely that these Gentiles, that they had previously had already adapted a Jewish lifestyle, especially with regard to food. So, Zetterholm says, it doesn't make sense. Because these God-fearing Gentiles wouldn't have been serving lobster. So that doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense. And Zetterholm goes on to say, a few pages later, he says, the problem in Antioch then was probably the degree of intimacy in social relations. It probably didn't affect the food they ate, but rather the ritual of community meals. Such matters as seating at the table and how the wine and the food were handled may have indicated to some Jews, like James, who did not share Paul's ideology regarding the equal standing of the non-Jews before God, that the Jewish identity of the community was threatened. The delegation from James, the circumcision faction that Peter feared, seems to have recommended that the status of the non-Jews should be altered. The reason for this may simply have been an effort to try to get the ethnic identity and the social intercourse to correspond. Which is to say, you've got all these Gentiles who are doing all this Jewish stuff, make them into Jews. If the Jews and non-Jews socialize as if they belong to the same ethnic group, James' representatives may have thought it best to have the non-Jews turned into Jews in spite of the earlier agreement from Jerusalem. This does not mean that James had changed his mind on the general principle that non-Jews could be saved without becoming Jews, only that he disagreed with Paul on the implications for social interaction resulting from this theology. So according to James, non-Jews could very well be connected to the Jesus movement, but only if the distinction between Jew and non-Jew was manifest also in social relations. All right, I know that was a long passage from a book to read to you, a really long passage, but I just felt like Zetterholm really hit the nail on the head for what's going on in Antioch. And we should probably hit the same nail a few more times to drive it home. What does he mean? Let's take another go at this passage with that perspective. We'll start in verse 11 again. When Cephas came to Antioch. Peter came to Antioch. Okay, Peter came to Antioch. Peter came to Antioch, the city in which Paul and Barnabas were ministering. We've met this Antioch community already. Large Jewish community, many synagogues in Antioch. One of them being the synagogue of the Christianos, the Jewish believers. And specifically, Paul and Barnabas are ministering there among these Jewish believers to God-fearing Gentile believers like Titus. We've learned all this. And so what's happened now is Peter has come from Jerusalem to see what's going on in Antioch, to see the work there, because Antioch has become the number two city after Jerusalem for Jewish believers, like the number two explosion of evangelism and people becoming believers, Antioch. And so Peter's come down here. In Antioch, the believers were first called Christians, remember that? And there probably was, several synagogues of these Christianos. Anyway, the believers in Antioch probably sent to Peter, and they probably sent to Jerusalem and said, "Come, teach us. Tell us his stories. come and teach us his teachings. You know, can you imagine that? To be able to say, why don't we send for Peter and bring Peter down? You know, he's one of the... What was that like? And to have Peter there and say, what was it like to walk with him? What was it like to know him? What was it like to be with him? What was he like? So this, I think, is why Peter's in Antioch. And there he is in Antioch. And Peter's discovering this amazing world. This amazing metropolitan. I mean, Antioch is huge compared to Jerusalem, compared to Capernaum, where Peter grew up. Peter's in New York City. This is, you know, and it's just amazing. All these Jewish believers, it's great, myriads, and all these God-fearing Gentile believers, the disciples of Paul and Barnabas, and they're all mingling freely together, and they are all worshiping together. They worshiped with the Jewish believers, the Gentiles did, and they kept the Sabbath and the festivals along with the Jewish believers to the extent that they were able to do that, and they fellowshipped with the Jewish believers. And they ate and they drank with the Jewish believers at Oneg. And at ritual meals, at festival meals. They had festival meals together and so forth. And Peter arrives and he sees this mixture of Jewish and Gentile believers. And he has no issues with it. Why would he? After all, it was through Peter that this whole thing got started. We always think it's Paul, but it wasn't. It was Peter. It was through the revelation that God gave to Peter when the sheet came down from heaven. Remember the sheet with the animals in it? And God says, get up, Peter, kill and eat. And he says, what I've made clean, don't call unclean. And so it was Peter who took the first step across that line, tore down the wall, went into a Gentile home, preached the gospel to the Gentile Cornelius. That was Peter. He went to the God-fearing Gentiles in Caesarea, and he saw them. He saw them receive the Spirit. He saw them receive the Spirit with his own eyes, and most importantly, or most scandalously, he ate and he drank with them. Remember the shock that the other apostles had back in Jerusalem when Peter got back from that? Acts 11, he gets back in Jerusalem from Caesarea. And he goes and he sees the brothers and they say to him, you went to uncircumcised men and you ate with them. What are you doing? What's the problem with eating with uncircumcised men in the first place? Well, Peter explained to Cornelius. He says, when he went down there to Caesarea, he said, he comes into, this is Acts 10:28, he says to Cornelius, you yourselves know, because they're Gentile God-fearers, they're familiar with Jewish tradition and Jewish custom, they've been around the synagogue, so he says to them, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit anyone of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any person common or unclean. So Peter says, he says, everybody knows this. You know it's unlawful for me to associate with you as a Gentile. Was it unlawful? Because it's not in the Torah. In the Torah, it doesn't say that it's unlawful to associate with a Gentile. So in what way was it unlawful? It was unlawful according to the halakha of the first century. Jews were not supposed to eat food, even kosher food, as long as, you know, they weren't supposed to eat meat or drink wine that had been prepared by a Gentile. We've learned this before. Why? Because of the possibility of defilement. Because of the possibility of contact with idols. Because of other Gentile defilements. Because the Gentiles themselves were probably defiled through contact with idols. And they probably were. They almost certainly were. Cornelius was. He was defiled. I know he's a God-fearing man, but he was a centurion, and as a centurion, you don't get away being a centurion without participating in the Roman cult. He was serving. He was serving as a centurion. He was participating in Roman rituals. There's no question. from a first century Orthodox observant halakhic perspective, Peter, don't go in there. That's a Roman centurion. Don't eat that. You know what I'm saying? So, Peter considered it unlawful for a Jew to associate or visit with a Gentile. And the rest of the apostles were completely shocked that he would do so. Okay, that was that. That's back in Acts 10. But now, okay, coming back to Galatians, as Paul's retelling the story, years later, Paul tells us about, it's years later, Peter's come down to Antioch. And he sees how much things have changed since those days, since the days of Cornelius and the shock. And here now, he sees Jewish believers and God-fearing Gentile believers eating together, mingling together, no doubt hosting each other in each other's homes, fellowshipping together. And he does the same thing. Peter freely enters in, does the exact same thing, until some more guests from Jerusalem arrive. So we read in verse 12, before certain men from James came, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. All right, we need to answer some questions. Who are the certain men from James? And what is the circumcision party? You would think that the circumcision party is the meal after a bris. It's not. The circumcision party, as these men from James belong to the circumcision party, which represents a faction, a sect, within the Jewish believers that reject Paul's doctrine of Gentile inclusion. So the circumcision party, they reject Paul's gospel. But these are Jewish. Understand, these are not bad guys. They're Avionim themselves, probably coming from Jerusalem. They're important. These weren't just like some guys showed up from Jerusalem. These are men from James, and Peter, the head of the 12, is intimidated by them. So they're important. These are important people. Representatives of James, the brother of the Master, head over the believers. And they come to Antioch. Why? We don't know why they came to Antioch, but they do. And on their arrival, they express their disapproval over this free intermingling of Jewish and Gentile believers. So they're the circumcision party, they're not saying that these Gentiles need to be circumcised in order to be saved. That is a contention that comes up later, but not yet. Instead, as Zetterholm suggested to us, these men were only trying to bring the Gentiles to the next obvious step. It's kind of like this. Imagine a guy comes in here and he says, "You guys wearing those kippahs, you look Jewish. Why don't you become Jewish? Close the gap." Because this is confusing to me. I can't tell who's Jewish and who's not. And so that's what Zetterholm is suggesting. That they're saying if the Gentile believers were fellowshipping and worshiping and eating within Jewish space, they should just go and become Jewish and everything would be simpler. If they chose not to, then they should step aside from Jewish space, from the Jewish community. They should be quarantined, so to speak, so that the distinction remains clear. And it's this quarantining that's happening when Peter pulls back. Now we have the same issue. We have the same issues in Messianic Judaism today, all the time. It's always the issue. This is our issue. It's our question. Gentiles start doing Jewish things. Why? And it's confusing. And it blurs the lines of distinction. And so here's the thing. I mean, maybe if when you start to see this, you realize our problems are not new problems. They're ancient problems. They're biblical problems. They are the same problems that the disciples and the apostles and the disciples of the apostles were wrestling with, that they were suffering through. So how's that? We're doing something right when the Bible suddenly is relevant to us and applies to us. We've made the same, we've recreated, so to speak, the situation of the first century in the Messianic Jewish movement, which is amazing, truly amazing. Anyway, it should be encouraging to have these problems, is what I'm saying. Anyway, under their influence, Peter withdraws, right? He steps back. He steps back from fellowship with these Gentile believers. Barnabas, his partner in missions, withdraws from the table, fellowship with the Gentile believers. The rest of the Jewish believers, they see Peter, they see Barnabas. It's like, okay, new program here. New program. We're gonna have separate seating. We're gonna put up a mechitza. Gentiles over here, right? So this is what's going on. And Paul sees where this is going. Do you see where this is going? I see where this is going because I see where it went. Paul sees where this is going. What this is going to result in is two different religions. You're going to get two different. You're going to get a Jewish Jesus religion out of this, and a Gentile Jesus religion out of this. That's what the end result of this process is going to be. And so Paul doesn't like that idea. And so he takes a really bold step, and he even steps out of line. He plucks up his courage, and he rebukes Peter. Now you don't just rebuke Peter. You don't do that. That's chutzpah. That's completely... You don't go up to Peter and say, you know, I rebuke you to your face. But that's what Paul did. It says, when I saw their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel. And this was his angle. This was his line. Because one thing that Paul had over Peter was education. Halakha. He knew halakha. He was a Pharisee. He's a student of Gamaliel. So he's got something over Peter. You know, okay, Peter, yeah, you were with the Master 3 years and you saw all the miracles and you heard all his teachings. But I bet you don't know the oral traditions like I do. I bet you don't know what to do and come up with any exigency of halakhic questions. So this is a halakhic statement. He says, when I saw their conduct was not in step, in walk, it would say in the Greek, in the walk of the truth of the gospel, in the halakha of the truth of the gospel. What is the halakha of the truth of the gospel in this situation that Paul's referring to? I think it's Paul's belief that Gentile believers are part of the covenant and so on, no longer just Gentile sinners, no longer just pagans, cleansed in Messiah. And this new status should enable free social mingling and eating together. Because this matter had already been established by Peter in the sheet from heaven and the Cornelius incident. There was a precedent. There was already a halakhic precedent in the community of the believers. It was already an accepted halakhic practice that Peter was backing up on. And check it out, Peter, you are the guy who brought us here. You're the one who started this, like, let's hang out with Gentiles thing. So Paul says, when I saw their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile, not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? Which sounds like Dr. Seuss. Here's what he said there, though. He said, if you, though you're Jewish, have been up until now freely mixing with Gentile believers and eating with them and eating their food and fellowshipping and worshiping with them, unlike the common Jewish standard, the common standard, you've been acting not like a Jew. How then can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? It doesn't mean that Peter was heretofore living as a Gentile in the sense of not keeping Torah or not keeping Sabbath or anything like that. God forbid. It means that he was associating with the Gentiles and setting aside the halakhic concern about food prepared by Gentiles and about Gentile defilement, those halakhic concerns, which if you're interested, you can look it up, you can study this out. This goes back to the 18 measures enacted by the Sanhedrin of Hillel and Shammai. But anyway, so he says, we're setting aside those concerns. Let me read you Galatians 2:14 from the Young's Literal. It says, Young's Literal translation, He says to Peter, if thou, literally, if thou, being a Jew, in the manner of the nations dost live, and not in the manner of the Jews, how the nations dost thou compel to Judaize? And that's really, you know, that's pretty literal from the Greek, Judaize. This is where we get the appellation in the first place, Judaizer. This is the original context of Judaizing. It refers to the ambitions of the circumcision party for the conversion of the Gentile believers to bring them under the law in the same manner as Jewish believers, requiring them to undergo circumcision. I can prove it from the only other time the word appears in the Bible. Okay, it's here, Judaize, but it also appears, I mean, because this is an unusual Greek word, it also appears in the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, in the book of Esther. Esther, chapter 8, verse 17, where it says, I'll just read that to you from the King James, 8:17, because I like the King James, very literal. It says, and many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. And so the Septuagint version says, and many of the Gentiles were circumcised and Judaized for fear of the Jews. Same word. So what is it to Judaize? It's to become Jewish. So what Paul is saying to Peter, I think you're getting this. He says to Peter, let me get this straight. If you, though you're a Jew, have been living like a Gentile in regard to intermingling with Gentiles, and not like a Jew who would be quarantining Gentiles, then how can you force the Gentiles to Judaize, to become Jewish? So in later terms, you know, you're going to learn in later centuries that the Judaize changes. It starts to mean to persuade Gentiles to live like Jews, which is how our translations render it. Which could be to keep the Sabbath in any measure, to keep the Torah in any measure, attending the synagogue, eating matzah at Passover. These are all the fathers, the church fathers would call all of that Judaizing. That's all Judaizing. To believe in a literal 1,000-year reign of Messiah on earth, the church fathers would call that Judaizing. That's Judaizing. But that's not what it meant here in Galatians. Judaizing is the goal of the circumcision party to compel the Gentile God-fearers in Antioch to become Jewish. All right, you got it. So Paul says, if you're a Jew, and you live like a Gentile, and that you fellowship with Gentiles, and you eat their food, and not like a Jew who separates from them, then how can you force the Gentiles to become Jews? How can you switch like that? How can you just switch your practice and your opinion? And so he goes on to explain. He says to Peter, I think, he's sort of paraphrasing now, we ourselves are Jews by birth, not Gentile sinners. Yet we know that a person is not justified by works of the Torah. We're going to learn that works of the law, works of the Torah, we'll learn about that. But through faith in Jesus Christ. So also we have believed in Christ Jesus in order to be justified by faith in Christ and not by works of the Torah. Because by the works of the Torah, no one will be justified. But if in our endeavor to be justified in Christ, we too are found to be sinners, is Christ then a servant of sin? Certainly not. For if I rebuild what I tore down, I prove myself to be a transgressor. All right, this is a great example of a Pauline passage that makes no sense. I mean, no matter how you read this, you're gonna come out of this and you're gonna say, I think I got that. Right? But we're gonna make sense of this. We're going to figure this out. We're just gonna start with one line of it today. Verse 18, where he says, if I rebuild what I tore down, I prove myself to be a transgressor. So let me reread the whole thing. And I'm going to throw in a few clarifications. Now this time, pay attention. This time, wake up, pay attention and say, what does this mean? Okay? Move out of that sermon mode, that sort of zoning sermon mode, and come back to actually studying the text with me. So, verse 15. We ourselves are Jews by birth, not Gentile sinners. We know that a person, he says a person, so neither Jewish nor Gentile, any person, we know that no person, a person is not justified by the works of the law. What are the works of the law? I'll just give it away right away. Conversion, circumcision, signs of the covenant. But instead a person is justified through faith in Yeshua the Messiah. So we, that's us Jewish people, we the Jewish people also have believed in the Messiah, Yeshua, in order to be justified by faith in Messiah and not by the works of the law, Jewish status, conversion, circumcision, signs of the covenant. Because by the works of the law, no one will be justified. But if in our endeavor to be justified in the Messiah, we too were found to be sinners, what? By eating and fellowshipping with Gentiles. If that's what the gospel brought us to, by eating and fellowshipping with Gentiles, and then it turns out that that was a sin, and we've been sinning all this time, then you got to ask yourself, is Messiah a servant of sin? Does coming to faith in Messiah bring us to break the Torah and to sin? Does becoming a believer mean we forsake Torah? Is eating and fellowshipping with non-Jews a sin against the Torah? And the answer is, certainly not. For if I rebuild what I tore down, then I prove myself to be a transgressor. So it's as if to say to Peter, Peter, if you, of all people, if you, of all people, rebuild this wall of division between Jew and Gentile, if you remove yourself from fellowship with Gentiles, if you refuse to eat their food, if you refuse to worship with them, if you refuse to count them for a minion maybe, I don't know. If you rebuild this barrier that you originally tore down, then, since you yourself were the first of the apostles to tear it down, and now you're putting it back up, then you're admitting that this whole time, since you tore it down, you've been wrong and you've been in sin. And you prove yourself to have been living in sin this whole time. And you led us all into transgression in the name of Messiah. If I rebuild what I tore down. That's Paul's rebuke to Peter. That's his rebuke. It's a legal rebuke. It's a halakhic legal rebuke. How did Peter receive this rebuke? How did he answer? You know, Paul didn't tell us. I would love to hear the answer. I would love to know the other side of this story. I really would. I'd love to hear Peter say, it's not exactly the way it went down. I don't know. Ultimately, Paul was right though. Because Peter does concede. How do we know he concedes? We know he concedes because a couple years later, Acts 15, Peter offers an opinion, a legal opinion, and he puts it this way. He says, Acts 15, verse 7, "Brothers, you know that in the early days God made a choice among you that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe. And God, who knows the heart, bore witness to them by giving them the Holy Spirit just as he did to us. And he made no distinction between us and them, having cleansed their hearts by faith. Now therefore, why are you, the circumcision party, putting God to the test by placing a yoke on the neck of the disciples that neither our fathers nor we have been able to bear?" So he comes around to support Paul's position in Acts 15. And these are beautiful words. And we should say it's the festival of Hanukkah today. We should say, may God, who knows the heart and bears witness of us as well, by giving us the Holy Spirit, just as he did for them, may God, who knows the heart at this holiday of Hanukkah, may he kindle fire in your heart, flames of faith, light in the darkness, increasing and not decreasing. May you have light. May you know the light. May you be the light of the world. May he cleanse our hearts by faith. That's what Peter said. He has cleansed their hearts by faith. May he cleanse our hearts that we may serve sincerely.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.